David, you spent a week in the African bush with this guy. Tell us what his story of the Baghdad invasions. I mean, take us through what he did.
Well, it's extraordinary. He lives on a reserve in South Africa, and he was watching the shock and awe bombardment of Baghdad that I think we all watched on television back in 2003. And he said that he grew up in Africa, but he was always very aware of stories in the Second World War, particularly of animals in zoos being killed in Berlin when the Allies bombed and took Berlin. Thousands of animals died in Berlin. He said it happened in Afghanistan, it happened in Kosovo. And so he got on the phone. And he's reasonably well connected politically in South Africa, and he managed to talk to people in the US and Britain who were at a reasonable high level and said to them, "You know, there's hundreds of animals in the Baghdad Zoo. It's the finest zoo in the Middle East. Hundreds and hundreds of exotic species, you know, directly in the line of fire. What are you doing about all these animals?" And he got no response, or people said, "We're not doing anything about it." So he decided that he would do something about it. And literally, he flew to Kuwait with his own money and talked his way into Iraq.
And so when he got there, did he just walk in and what clutch a couple of lines under his arms and walk out again? I'm sure it's more
Well,
complicated
it's a
than
little
that.
bit more complicated, but not a lot, actually. I mean, he turned up in Kuwait and he had various paperwork from various people, but the Americans wouldn't let him in. And this is literally days after they started their invasion. There are tanks going in as he's in Kuwait. And he said the Americans wouldn't let him in, and that was a bit of an issue. And then he said he realized that it wasn't the American border, it was the Kuwaiti border. So he went to the Kuwaiti authorities, and they said, "Yeah, sure, you can go in." So
you lunatic, if you want.
So he got a hire car. He went in with, there was a couple of Kuwaiti guys who worked at Kuwait Zoo who knew people in Baghdad they hadn't seen for ages, wanted to see them. They pitched up at the border with all the American military convoys with a car full of veterinary supplies. And the US soldier at the border just couldn't believe his eyes. So these three guys, everyone else was trying to get out. There were queues of people trying to get out across the border in the other direction. And these three guys wanted to get in. And he said to them, "You do know there's a war on, don't you?"
The piece you wrote in the Observer magazine yesterday, you described the fact that he's driving through all these places in 2003, and it was a bomb site. That's not even a metaphor. And so when he wandered in, your piece starts with the fact that he didn't know he's being tracked by a lion until he sort of saw it. What was that about?
There's these palaces all over Baghdad, and there's this one that was owned by Uday Hussein, one of Saddam's sons. And he said that he knew there were lions there. It was quite well documented in the years before the war that Uday had these lions. He went to save the animals at the zoo, but he also wanted to work out what else he could do. So he goes to this palace. He's one of the first people in there. You know, the gates are sort of rocking on their hinges. And he said he walked into this enclosure with knee-high grass everywhere. And there was a dog there, a live dog, just sat looking at him. And he thought, well, no one's feeding these lions. They can't be here, or the dog wouldn't be there. And so he starts walking through the enclosure, and he said that in Africa, or I suppose wherever, you recognise a lion in the grass, but just it twitches its ear. And he said, and he saw this distinctive twitch of an ear, and just a few yards from him, in this grass, in the middle of Baghdad, in this palace, and thought, oh, no, there's a lion. And then there was another one, and there were four of these things, two of them which are now moving towards him. And he said that the key when you see a lion is that you stay dead still and you gently back away.
So what did he do?
He ran. He said he just all went out the window. He turned around and he bolted.
What did they do?
I don't know. Well, they didn't get him because clearly they didn't survive to tell the tale.
How many animals did he sort of rescue from this situation, and what did he do with them? And if he couldn't get out, where did he take them?
No, I mean, when he got there were only 35 animals surviving. There were hundreds at the zoo originally, but a lot had escaped. Some of the lions had actually escaped and had been rounded up by US soldiers who were a bit alarmed to find wild lions running around when they got to Baghdad. A lot had been eaten. Very hungry people. Anything that was plump and tasty had gone. Pretty much what was left was things that had teeth and claws to defend themselves. He basically saved the ones that were at the zoo, of which there are about 35, which involved getting food and water to them and cleaning out the cages. He went around the city trying to find animals that were elsewhere. The lions in Uday's palace. There was a couple of others kind of There were zoos officially, but I think they were fronts for animal trading organisations, illegal animal traders. He sort of scooped up animals from there. He went and found this herd of beautiful, purebred, thoroughbred horses, some of the finest Arabian horses in the world. Saddam Hussein had a herd of these horses. And he went and found them. He wrote a book about this called Babylon's Ark, which we should say. And this incredible scene, because he gets the Americans on side, and he's got local people on side. And at one point, he gets the former Republican Guard, the Iraqi sort of elite forces, working at the zoo with the American soldiers.
Can we get this man working on world peace or something? I mean, it just
I'll just finish the story. So there's this incredible scene he describes in the book where there's this. It was by the Arab the famous jail. Abu Ghraib. Behind there, this guy had these horses, and you know, you can't move horses easily, so they had to get hold of these three flatbed trucks, and the Americans gave them a tank. The Americans came with the tank, and so imagine you're there, you're a horse thief, and you've got this sort of herd of very nice horses, and all of a sudden you've got these crazy guys coming at you with a tank, saying, "Give us the horses back."
The horses didn't have to go on the tanks, did they?
No, the horses went in the truck. The tank was there to protect them. And so this is incredible. Sort of went around the city scavenging and saving the various animals in various parts. Put them all in the zoo because it was a central place to look after them.
So how is Baghdad Zoo now?
Well, I think it's okay. I mean, he's not been back since he left in 2003. We should say I haven't been. This is all from conversations with Lawrence. But the part, the zoo is at the side of the very famous Al Zahra Park, which is a huge, almost like Central Park for Baghdad. You must have seen on television the giant sort of cross swords, the famous parade ground. That's just right next door to the zoo. So he's not been back, but the Americans basically revigorated the park and the zoo with it as a beacon of hope, I suppose, for the local people. They fixed the irrigation systems and it all became green again. The zoo got 5 million visitors last year. It gets loans of animals from abroad, which is quite important because it helps to maintain standards and improve standards. I think as far as he knows, it's thriving.
Lawrence Anthony, you mentioned he's a conservationist. We've just talked about his work in Baghdad. Give us a pen portrait of who he is and where did he come from?
Well, his ancestors are British, actually. His grandfather was a miner who left Berwick-upon-Tweed in the 1920s to work the gold mines in South Africa. He grew up in sort of colonial days in Southern Africa. But he said he went into property, but he always had an interest in conservation. He grew up in the bush and it stayed with him. And about a decade ago, there was a game reserve in Zululand, which is where his family were from, that came up for sale. And he bought it, and in doing so, he turned, I suppose, a hobby into a career.
Now, for some people, going into Baghdad just after the American invasion to save lions and all sorts of other animals would be dangerous enough. But he's done other quite dangerous things in Africa itself.
Yeah, this was nuts. This is how I first heard about him. A couple of years ago, there's a sprawling game. Nature reserve called Garamba National Park, which sort of borders several countries in North Africa, and it's home to the last of the northern white rhino, of which scientists think there are four animals left. Now, a few years ago, Garamba was invaded by a very nasty bunch called the Lord's Resistance Army, who are a rebel group fighting the Ugandan government, have been for decades. They're child soldiers, mutilations, accused of rapes and war crimes and all sorts of terrible, terrible things. They invaded this park. They started killing game rangers. They killed UN soldiers that were sent there to keep the peace. And again, Lawrence Anthony decides that he needs to do something. He needs to try and do something to protect the rhinos, because he said if those rhinos go extinct, either because the rebels kill them or because with the game rangers are too scared to work, they could be poached, it'd be the largest animal, mammal, land mammal, to go extinct since the woolly mammoth. You know, it would be a disaster. So he finds out that the rebels have come out of the jungle, or at least the political wing have come out of the jungle, and are talking to the Ugandan government in Sudan. So he just turns up. He didn't have a visa. He bribed his way across the border. He turns up at the peace talks. Finds out who's the most senior official representing the LRA, this murderous bunch of rebels, walks up to him and says, "I want to talk to you about rhinos." Got a very sort of hostile reception to start with, but talked his way into them and eventually got invited to come and talk to the actual guys on the ground, the guys doing the fighting, the next day, and everyone warned him against it, but he went. You know, these are what you see on TV, guys with guns and jeeps and in the jungle and
big machetes.
All that stuff. And you know, he went completely unarmed, you know, white man.
Was he successful?
Yeah, he was. I mean, it turns out that the rebels said, we didn't realise there was only four. We thought there were hundreds and thousands of these animals. And actually, they're sacred to us. They're a sort of a sacred totem of our tribe. And so when the rebels signed a peace deal with the government, it included clauses, legal clauses, that they would work to protect the rhinos.
Now, this chap sounds quite charming. In your sort of few days with him in South Africa, what was he like? What did he charm you?
He's charismatic. I don't think he tried to charm me. I don't think he needed to. I think just the story.
His actions speak for themselves.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
What have you done recently? Exactly. What does he do now? What's his sort of focus?
Well, when he got back from Baghdad, he set up something called the Earth Organization, which is sort of a conservation group that takes a very pragmatic approach. He's very hostile to what he calls bunny huggers. He doesn't do sort of sentimentality with animals. For example, he's not into sort of militant animal rights. He agrees that animals could be tested on for medicine, that kind of stuff. So he set up the Earth Organization. And he also works with elephants. He's got a herd of elephants. He lives on a game reserve. I mean, he's a tourist guy in a way, although the money goes into conservation. And on the reserve, there are some elephants. Now, these elephants, I suppose they're delinquent, or they were delinquent. He's reformed them. They were going to be shot. They broke out. They knocked things down. And he worked with them, and he just calmed them down through nothing other than just hanging out with them. And they got to the point where he described it as, it was almost like someone had turned off a light switch. He said one day the aggression was gone. And the lead elephant, Nana, the matriarch of the herd, a giant thing, just approached him. There was a fence between them. But the fence would break very quickly if the elephant charged. Put its trunk through the fence and touched him. And he said, we've got to let them out. He said it was almost like someone had turned off a light and the aggression had gone. And that was a few years ago. So now these elephants sort of wander around on the reserve. They're wild animals. You know, you wouldn't want to approach them. It's like the animals you see on safari, not the animals you see in a zoo or in a carnival or a circus. They're wild animals. They could kill you. They would kill you very easily. They have attacked him and other people at the reserve. But he has this incredible bond with them. With the animals, with these elephants.
Now, I believe you tried to video him calling out to these elephants. We've got a clip, I think, of him making some elephant sounds.
Come, Nana. I'm calling quietly because I'm trying not to call the bulls that are on the other side, who'll also come. Come, girl. Come, girl. And now we wait.
Have you trained them to do this, or is this just something that you're able to do?
You can't train. I mean, they're wild elephants. They just know me, and they know that call, and they know it's me, so that they'll come.
Now, David, it must be said that you did video, but the video didn't include the elephants actually coming, or at least you were running away as they did come.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get across just the situation that we were in that. Sorry, we're miles away from anywhere in the African bush. There's a Land Rover, but elephants will go through a Land Rover, you know, with great ease. And we're calling this herd of wild elephants towards us. He'd seen them half a mile or so away, and so he made the call, which isn't really an elephant noise. It's just him, you know. I think they just recognise his voice. For about 5 or 10 minutes, nothing happened, and then you see the bushes start to rumble and shake, and these elephants appear, and they move quickly for such big animals.
How many of them were there?
The herd is about 12, and I think about 6 or 7 turned up.
Did the large bulls he was worried about stay wherever they were?
No, they didn't. They came.
They turned up too. Oh, good.
They turned up too. Yeah. So we had mothers and babies, possibly the most dangerous combination in the animal kingdom, followed by angry bulls.
And he also does work with humans as well, with Zulus. Well, tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, he's very. As I said before, he's very into conservation, and I mean, obviously. He lived through a period of great change in South Africa, culturally, politically. And his big idea, I suppose, is that the old ways of doing conservation have got to change. He said, you know, 95% of game reserves in Africa are run along old sort of colonial grounds with big fences and big guns.
Keep the people out.
Keep the people out.
Charge tourists to come in, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Now, he says if you don't start involving the local communities, that's just doomed to failure. Because the local communities will come on and poach and kill the animals because, you know, they don't fully understand what's going on. And so what he's trying to do is he's trying to involve Zulu tribes that live in the local area who all own land or have land that's been passed down through the families. He's trying to get them to pool the land, and rather than farm it, to use it as a game reserve. The land actually borders the very famous Umfolozi game reserve in South Africa, which is where they saved a lot of the southern white rhinos in the early part of the century. So in theory, you could pool all of the Zulu land, and then you could knock down the fence to Umfolozi, and all the animals could come onto their land, and they could charge, the Zulu people could charge tourists and run the kind of game expeditions that you get all across southern Africa.
Well, another bit of stunning audio you recorded there for us. This is one of the Zulu chiefs actually introducing himself.
Before I come on that, I would like to introduce myself.
Yes, of course.
I'm Inkosi Piwa Inkosi Kagide Biela of the late Inkosi Kanyiso Biela Kamkhombisi Kadumezweni Kamkhosana. I'm here as the leader of the Biela clan.
Now, David, who was that chap?
This guy's incredible. I mean, as he said, he's the leader of the Biela clan, which is one of the Zulu tribes. He's very, very supportive of this Royal Zulu game project. He's the leader of one of the five tribes who own the land, and he's trying to convince colleagues and people in his tribe that it has benefits to them. But we should also say that he's very famous in a way because his great-great-grandfather was a very, very important Zulu chief at the Battle of Isandlwana, which, if you've seen the film Zulu, which I'm sure everybody has, that was at a place called Rorke's Drift the day after the Battle of Isandlwana, where the Brits got their butts kicked. The Zulus just completely trounced the British army. It was a huge, embarrassing defeat at the time. And what happened was at the beginning of the battle, though, that the Brits opened up with the cannons, and the Zulus had never fought against people with cannons before, and they panicked, and they all started running away. And this guy's relative, he was a big sort of chief himself at the time, but he stood up and he yelled at everyone. He said, "No one gave you permission to run away. Turn and fight." And they did. But as he said it, he was shot between the eyes and died. But he rallied the cause, and the Zulu army sort of then went on and trounced the Brits.
Okay, David, we'll leave that tale there. Now, if you want to read David's full story about his trip to South Africa, his conversations with Zulu chiefs, and the whole thing with Lawrence Anthony, go to the Guardian website, guardian.co.uk/environment. There's also a gallery of great pictures there. You can also find out in there why you had to put a goat on expenses.